Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, we talked about the sheer numbers of inmates in Ohio's prison. This show is part of an occasional series on mass incarceration. Coming up, we'll be talking about the number of prison inmates who return and don't return to prison. That's recidivism issue. And we'll also be hearing from victims. Today, we continue our occasional series on mass incarceration with a look at the parole system in the state of Ohio. 2 years ago, when Ohio's parole rate plunged to below 7%, state prison officials said that they would make changes to improve inmates' parole odds. Many inmates and their families, however, question whether there have been any changes. Joseph, an inmate at Marion Correctional Institution, wrote recently that he has been incarcerated for 19 years for armed robbery. He writes, "I was sentenced to 9 to 28 years. I've seen the parole board for 3 times, and each time there has been different rules applied to my case." That is a common sentiment in the dozens of letters All Sides has received from Ohio prison inmates on this topic. Coming up, the chairwoman of the Ohio Parole Board. Joining us now by phone from Cincinnati is the director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, David Singleton. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you so much for having me again, Ann.
People often refer to old law and new law offenders. What does that mean, and what is the impact on inmate parole?
Well, in 1996, the state of Ohio abolished parole for most prisoners, and it went to a new system that is colloquially called truth in sentencing. And under truth in sentencing provisions, what happens is, when someone commits a crime that warrants prison, they get a flat number. They get one number that they have to do most of that time. For example, the judge may sentence you to 9 years, and you might get a little bit of good time off of that, but not much. The old system was indeterminate sentencing, meaning that you would get a range, a bottom number that would be your parole eligibility date, and the top number being the date by which you had to be released if the parole board did not release you earlier. That's an indeterminate sentence, like 5 to 15 years. That would be an indeterminate sentence. The 5 years would be your parole eligibility date. The 15 years would be when you'd have to be released by statute. So now, for the vast majority of people who are in the criminal justice system, they are getting a flat number. They're getting a determinate sentence. And the old law inmates pre-1996 are the ones who are on indeterminate time.
And what has been the ramifications for them with the being part of the old law population?
Well, one of the issues is that there are a lot of folks who have been locked up a very long time under the old law. And what's ironic is that if they were being sentenced now, today, many of them would be getting determinate sentences that are much, much less than what they're actually serving. We get letters often from prisoners who I'm reasonably confident would not be in as long as they have been if they were sentenced under the new regime. And there's been some litigation around that, some lawsuits that have been brought that have not really gotten anywhere. Mm-hmm. But it is a problem, and it seems that we have a two-tiered system that's unfair.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today, we're continuing our occasional series on the issue of mass incarceration in the state of Ohio and across the country. Today, we're talking about the parole system in the state of Ohio. My guest right now, David Singleton. He's director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. We're not going to get into specific cases today, listeners, but if you want to make general observations or have a question, you're welcome to call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Well, it doesn't seem to be there. It is a two-tiered system, and inmates are living together in that system, some from the old law and some from the new law.
That's exactly right. And so you'll have people who've committed the same offense, you know, perhaps similar circumstances, somebody under the old law is subject to the parole board, and they're spending a lot longer in prison than someone coming in after 1996. And that's what strikes many observers as unfair, and something needs to be done about that.
Has the parole board in Ohio been given any guidance as to how to manage these cases?
Well, there are factors that the parole board considers, and, you know, I think part of the problem is that there's a lack of transparency in terms of how the parole board actually evaluates these factors and makes decisions. And, you know, one of the concerns is that, or one of the concerns that we have, is that data is not driving the decision-making process. We have an excellent risk assessment tool in the state of Ohio. It's the Ohio Recidivism Assessment System, and it was developed. And I'm sure you'll have Ed Lasessa on when you do your segment on recidivism. But he's one of the leading criminologists in the country, researchers, and he developed at the University of Cincinnati this assessment tool that's been shown to work and predict accurately whether people are at risk for recidivism. And that tool, which ODRC has and uses, should be what drives the decision-making process at this point by the parole board. And I'm not confident that it does. I think that I hear time and time again, and some of the clients that I represent now who are coming up for parole and have been denied parole before, they're told, we can't let you out because of the nature and seriousness of your offense.
Mm-hmm.
And what strikes me is really fundamentally wrong with that is, you know, we can all agree that you know, crime's a serious issue, and certainly if you've killed someone, that's a serious crime. But the legislature has already set what the parameters are in terms of the minimum amount of time that the person would be subject to. And so what the parole board is doing is double counting that. And that should not be driving the decisions of the parole board. We ought to be taking a look at where the person is now. They've already come up for parole. They've served the minimum amount of time that has been imposed by the court and that is allowable by the legislature. And, you know, when folks come out for parole after serving a long sentence, we should be, or the parole board should be looking first and foremost at what is their recidivism risk. Let's use the ORAF to guide who we should be releasing and who we should be keeping in, and let that be what drives it rather than this this amorphous, we think that this crime is too serious to let you out right now.
I'm going to be talking with Cynthia Mauser, the chair of the Ohio Parole Board, in the upcoming segment. But from where you sit, David Singleton, at the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, what do you attribute this decrease in paroles, rate of parole in the state of Ohio in recent years?
Well, I think that, and I anticipate that one of the things that Chairwoman Mauser will say is that now we are left, we've seen the parole of less violent offenders, and now we have a more violent population. By violent, I mean the offense that they committed,
correct,
not necessarily who they are today. I think what is happening is that the parole board is looking at, you know, folks who now are in either on murder charges or sex offenses, and is sort of making the conclusion that means they must still be dangerous now. And that's why I brought up just a moment ago the need to have the decisions about whether we're going to let folks out be driven by what the risk assessment says. Because, you know, a lot of your listeners will think, okay, if somebody killed someone, that's going to mean that they're going to be out in the community killing again and again and again and again. But the data shows that some of the individuals who've committed the most serious offenses, like homicides, those are one-time offenses. Those are offenses that folks are very unlikely to commit again. In Michigan, the data there is that folks who were released on homicide cases recidivated for any crime, not a murder, at 2.7%. And that's not murder. It's not like they, 2.7% of them committed another homicide.
They just committed a crime to...
A crime. And that's a very, very, very low recidivism rate. So you can't just say, all right, somebody committed a murder 25 years ago, and, that means we're not going to let them out today. You've got to look at who they are today. You've got to look at, how have they adjusted in prison. I'm not taking the position that everybody who's locked up now ought to be coming home. No, there's some dangerous people who it's appropriate to keep locked up for public safety reasons. But the vast majority of folks who have committed crimes a long time ago are not folks who are going to recidivate today.
What about the process of parole and how the parole hearings are conducted? Is that an issue?
Well, I think it is. I think part of, the parole board has a difficult job to do. I am not going to say anything other than that. It's not an easy job to do. I think that part of what happens is that when you are in the system and seeing cases time and time again where people have been seriously victimized, it's hard not to get jaded. And I think what has been lost is that while we must care about victims, we have to. That is very important. We can't lose sight, though, of the fact that people who are in prison are people. And, we should not automatically conclude that they're bad. And they may have done something bad years ago, but we should not be writing people off. I think that the parole board, my biggest criticism of the parole board, recognizing that they have a very difficult job to do, is that I think they tend to write people off, and they tend to see the worst in people, rather than looking to whether the person has been redeemed, has been rehabilitated, and then letting the risk assessment drive whether or not they should be released. So I think that the primary shortcoming of the system is that, these parole board hearings aren't focusing adequately on risk of recidivism.
My guest is David Singleton. He's the director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Coming up, we're going to hear from Cynthia Mauser. She is the chair of the Ohio Parole Board. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, continuing our occasional series on mass incarceration today with a look at the parole system in the state of Ohio. 2 years ago, when Ohio's parole rate plunged to below 7%, state prison officials said that they would make changes to improve inmates' parole odds. Many inmates and their families, however, question whether there have been any changes. Richard is in the Marion Correctional Institution serving an 18-to-life sentence for second-degree murder. He wrote to us recently saying, "At the time I committed my crime, I was severely addicted to drugs and was on mind-altering drugs. The first time I seen the parole board, I had 13 and a half years in. That was 2005, and my maximum sentence was 240 months. Well, in 2008, I see the parole board again. They changed my max sentence to 888 months. That is totally unfair." There are lots of questions and concerns like this in the many letters we received from the inmates at Marion Correctional Institution. Still with us by phone is David Singleton, director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. And joining us now is the chair of the Ohio Parole Board, Cynthia Mauser. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
I want to address some issues that David Singleton brought up. Mm-hmm. One is the lack of transparency that he referred to. Tell us, what do you tell people about how you come to your decisions about paroles?
Well, what we tell people is that there are a list of statutory factors that the board is required to see, to consider, and that drives our decision making. Of those factors, criminal history is amongst probably one of the most important, as well as responses from the community, and then issues related to the inmate's adjustment and release planning.
When you talk about criminal history, mm-hmm. that you used that was the number one. I would imagine that's the biggest issue.
It is.
What is, why the point, why even a parole hearing anyway then? If that, what do you learn from a parole hearing, I guess, that mitigates a criminal history?
Well, we learn whether or not the offender has changed. Which is something that's important and correlated to parole success. Criminal history is still the number one factor related to parole success, but there are others. And we, from a parole hearing, we learn whether or not that person has advanced to an extent that they may not go out and commit a crime similar to the one that they're incarcerated for.
Well, how is a parole hearing conducted in a way that makes you confident that you're getting the right kind of information at that time?
We have gone through a lot of training, and we have made a lot of efforts to make sure that our parole system is set up that reflects current national practices, so that things are in place, so that the board members have all the tools available to them to make the best decisions that they can. And so we weigh and review information based on certain factors or domains that we know are correlated to parole success. We've also had training in things like motivational interviewing and other interviewing techniques so that we know what to ask for in certain types of cases. And then ultimately, the parole hearing is not just that institutional hearing. There's other parts to that process, which include victim conferences beforehand, and we offer offender conferences beforehand. And then if the decision is to propose parole, there's a what's called a full board open hearing. That is more of an open hearing where other people can participate. So it's several steps in the process, which I think is not necessarily known to everyone.
When you deny parole to somebody, mm-hmm. you list the reasons why.
Correct.
But they tend to be statutory descriptions of why, not what was it about your interview that led us believe that you have not achieved the level of rehabilitation suitable.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true.
Okay.
There is a section for a rationale where we expand upon those specifics related to that offense and the offender, but we're required by administrative rule to note certain factors and certain parts of a rationale to make that conclusion that mm-hmm. the person isn't suitable. So, yes, there's some verbiage that is the same from decision to decision, but the administrative rule requires us to note one of three specific things. So that's part of the reason why you see similar language throughout the decisions.
I've only heard anecdotes about people's experiences with the parole board.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what these questions are coming from right now. I heard that you do a lot of interviews by Skype?
Not Skype, by video conference.
By video conference.
Yes.
Okay. And then others are done in person.
Well, not any longer.
Not any longer.
It's almost exclusively video conference.
Why the change?
There were several reasons of why that occurred. Back when we were traveling to all of the 30-some institutions, there was a lot of time and resources spent on travel. And we made efforts to reduce travel costs. Also, the offenders that we see now, they're very serious offenders, and they have always required a majority vote by the board. And so in order to facilitate that with as many board members as possible participating in the hearing, we conduct them by video conference. So the offender is actually appearing before a majority of the board members and not just one. And more board members are given the opportunity to discuss the case with the offender and to ask questions that they think are relevant. So it gives more people the opportunity to participate, and a board member, the rest of the board members who have to vote on the case are not just reliant on one person who interviewed them.
Which can be the case when you do the in-person interviews in the past.
Yes, that's how it operated. And in the past, you know, there are many institutions now where we only, because this population that we're talking about, the parole-eligible population, is only about 9% of the entire prison population.
It's the old law people.
It is the old law people, but something that Mr. Singleton didn't point out earlier was that Senate Bill 2 maintained our discretionary release authority for a certain segment of new law, those being essentially lifers, those convicted of aggravated murder, murder, and some sex offenses. So the board's authority has been maintained for that group of very serious offenders. And that number is increasing and is almost... it's only about 1,000 difference from the old law inmates.
So the lower percentage of paroles in recent years is a function of a lower percentage or fewer eligible, and those are who have been convicted of worse crimes.
I think that's accurate, yes. Absolutely.
Are you frustrated? Well, before we move on, I want to remind folks you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest right now is Cynthia Mauser. She's the chair of the Ohio Parole Board. The video interviews that you do you feel like there's a certain remoteness to that? Like, I'd rather have David Singleton in the room right now.
Sure.
I'd always rather interview somebody in person because I feel like you have a different rapport with somebody when it seems more personal. Do you ever struggle with that? Like, you just like to be in the room with somebody and get the vibe from them, to be completely unscientific about it?
I was somewhat, you know, I've been on the parole board for a long time,
right?
With various positions.
Do you miss that? I guess.
And so I have that experience of going into the institutions and conducting the hearings, and then conducting them by video conferencing. And I don't really believe that there is anything that is missing from doing it by video conferencing, and the gains, the the more efficient use of resources. And the ability to have more board members participating in the hearing outweighs any loss of one-on-one contact with the inmate in the same room. So I think it's way more beneficial than the old system, particularly since many of the institutions only have a few eligible inmates per month that we need to hear. And so to devote a lot of travel time to get one hearing or one institution accomplished in a day isn't really an effective use of resources, where we can video conference and move from, you know, one institution to the next, and maybe conduct three institutions in one day instead of one.
What changes were implemented a couple years ago? I mentioned that at the outset of the program. I think I read an article by Alan Johnson of the Columbus Dispatch, who wrote in 2012 that there were going to be changes to improve the inmate odds for parole.
Well, I think that's it wasn't measures to improve their odds for parole.
Okay.
What we tried to do was improve communication between the board and the inmates, so the inmates understood the process that they were going to be subjected to, and that we were better communicating our reasoning to inmates and their supporters. So We were trying to be more transparent in our decision making, but there really was never any effort to improve the chance of parole. It was to help assist in understanding the process, all arenas or all parts of the process, and not just the one-on-one interview with the inmate.
How many inmates, as I mentioned earlier, the numbers of parolees, well, 2 years ago, Ohio's parole rate plunged to below 7%. What's it at now? How many people, for instance, were paroled last year?
Last year, there were 62 mm-hmm. people that
out
were
of
paroled.
How many were eligible?
It was about 1,000, I believe. Okay. So it was about a 5% rate last year. And again, when you look at who is incarcerated and who are responsible for making these decisions on, there is about 4,500 of the what's called old law inmates. About 50% of those inmates are serving sentences for homicide offenses, and the vast majority of those are serving sentences for aggravated murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then another 30% are sex offenders. And then another 20% is made up of a variety of other violent offenses, and then a very small percentage are some of the old law offenders who are still serving felony 4 offenses, felony 3 offenses from old law. So these folks are the very serious offenders that the penalties have not decreased for. I think that's something that is often misstated, is that had they been sentenced under current law, they would actually be better off. And that is simply not true.
For the really, really serious crimes.
Right. But that's who the majority of the folks we see, that's what they are convicted of. Those people, the sentences have actually increased in recent years.
What do inmates mean when they refer to a flop? They're very frustrated by that, where they go before the parole board mm-hmm. and they get more time.
They are, well, more time, I think, is also another
okay.
misconception. It's not really more time. You're just denied release, and you have to continue serving the sentence that was imposed.
So you say, like, I've read some of the parole, when someone's denied parole, I've read, okay, do another 3 years and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you come up with another 3 years from, that kind of a, or another 18 months or
sure.
whatever it might be? How
sure.
is that determined?
There's a variety of factors that are taken into consideration when we determine how much of their sentence they'll be required to continue to serve until we see them again. Statutorily, we're capped by 10 years. So the most that we can ask them to continue to serve until we see them again is 10 years. The number, it depends on how much time they've already served, their adjustment to the institution, and then all of the other community factors that we have to consider as well, responses from prosecutor, judge, any victims. We get responses from the community at large. If there's a particular type of program that we want the inmate to participate in before considering them again, how long that might take to do.
What about wardens and prison personnel
mm-hmm.
who are with them every day?
Mm-hmm.
Do you take any advice or recommendations from them?
Yes, we do. And I have implemented, we're about to finalize a process so that is, there's more of a process, I should say. Before it was, if a particular staff person, a warden, sort of felt like it, they could contact us in a variety of means. And
mm-hmm.
We've developed a process so that staff who would like to make comment on an inmate will be able to do so through a process that's set in place that the warden will ultimately be able to review before
and
it comes to us.
How does that rank in the realm of factors that you consider?
Any one factor, I think it's hard to say that this ranks more than this or
beyond the
beyond those that we know are statistically correlated to parole mm-hmm. success. But it is very important, the staff who see them day in and day out and have an opinion.
And who they are as people now.
Right. And how they're adjusting in the institution.
This is an email from Nancy. She said, you said you have to list up to three reasons or rationales for not granting people parole. If the only one listed is the serious nature of the crime, what do you suggest the inmate do to prepare for the next hearing, considering the fact they cannot go back into time and undo the crime they committed? Mm-hmm. That's what Nancy brought up there is repeated in a lot of, I can't go back and change what I did. What I did was horrible. Mm-hmm. I'm doing my time, but I'm changed now. I'm a new person. What can they do?
They can continue to serve their sentence in that mm-hmm. manner mm-hmm. and not not go backwards.
Several Ohio inmates have contacted our program, and one of their biggest concerns was despite their participation in prison rehabilitation programs and clean disciplinary records, they're still being denied parole. Again, you would say that it probably goes back to the original crime.
And not always. Yes, to some degree, but it's not just the mere participation in programming that's important. It's also that the offender can demonstrate that they've learned something from it and that they have changed in some way. And it's difficult to make that assessment when we've asked somebody to complete a certain type of program, and then they come in front of us and cannot recite the basics or cannot demonstrate how that program has helped them. So just merely completing it is not enough. There has to be a connection between that program and the factor or the reason or the need for taking that particular program.
Have you heard about inmates just giving up, that they just don't think there's a chance that parole even will ever work for them, that maybe it's the seriousness of their crime? They're going to end up doing time after time after time. Have you heard about that? And how do you respond?
I don't know that I've heard of that. There have been some instances where inmates have refused to appear at their parole hearings, and that's their prerogative, whether mm-hmm. or not they want to participate in the process. And then we make the decision as best we can based on that. But we hope that they will participate, because I think then the system works the best when we are able to process information from all sides.
If you could change one thing about the system to make it better, in your opinion, after many years of working within it, what would it be?
Well, that's a difficult question.
More money. Assuming everybody wants more money because everything's been cut.
I think one of the things, I don't know if I would necessarily change it, but I would like to have maybe some additional assessments for violence, for violent reoffending.
What about the issue that David Singleton brought up regarding the data not driving the decision-making process, and that the Wall Street Journal recently reported on software that is in use in Ohio that helps parole boards determine the best candidates for parole? Mm-hmm. Can you describe that to us and how you use that, or do you not?
I think what he was referring to was ORAS, the risk assessment.
Yes.
And we do the risk score is something that is considered in each decision, but even University of Cincinnati, who created that instrument, did not suggest that we use it for parole decision making. And it was not validated on the population of the long-term offender. And we are seeking to obtain a tool that will help us predict for violence. And, currently there is a sex offender specific tool. So we would like to be able to have a tool like that for the folks that are convicted of the other violent offenses, like the homicide offenses.
How does somebody get on the parole board?
I'm sorry?
How do you get on the parole board?
Oh, how are you appointed
to the
board?
It looks like when I looked at the list, most of them have correctional backgrounds.
Yes. Well, the process is that we are appointed by the director of the Department of mm-hmm. Rehabilitation and Correction. And in the statute, there are certain criteria that you, certain qualifications that you must have. You must have experience in correctional work is one of them. Mm-hmm. Law, I think social work, parole or probation. And so generally, if you make your interest known to the director and when there's a vacancy, you know, he considers those people that are interested or that, you know, are recommended. Sometimes I make recommendations. I'm not the appointing authority. Mm-hmm. So but it's an appointed position.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Cynthia Mauser, she's chair of the Ohio Parole Board. We'll continue our conversation about the parole system in Ohio as part of our ongoing series on mass incarceration when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We continue our occasional series on mass incarceration today with a look at the parole system in the state of Ohio. We just heard from Cynthia Mauser. She's the chair of the Ohio Parole Board. 2 years ago, when Ohio's parole rate plunged to below 7%, state prison officials said that they would make changes to improve inmates, to improve those odds for inmates. Cynthia Mauser said that isn't exactly accurate, that they just wanted to do a better job of helping prepare inmates for the process of the parole hearing. Many inmates and their families still question, though, whether or not there have been any changes or any improvements. One change has been the law regarding sentencing. There are the old law prisoners and the new law prisoners. Still with us by phone to talk about that from Cincinnati is David Singleton. He's director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Once again, David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
We were expecting to have a former inmate join us today to talk about the issue of judicial release. He did not make it, and we're sorry about that. But could you talk about the issue of judicial release? It was once referred to as shock probation. What is it, and has it changed somehow?
Well, judicial release is available to some prisoners who can't have more than 10-year sentence that they're serving in order to be eligible for judicial release. And basically, there are different categories based on when you can apply for judicial release. For example, if you're serving a sentence of less than 2 years, you have to wait 30 days before you get to the prison system to file for judicial release. If it's less than 5 years, you've got to serve 180 days before you can file a judicial release motion. 5 years, you can do it after 4 years of serving time in the prison system. And then less than 10 years, but more than five, you've got to wait 5 years to file. And basically what a judicial release motion is, it's a motion that is filed not with the parole board, but with a judge, the sentencing judge, and the judge looks at some factors, determines whether or not the release would compromise public safety or would demean the seriousness of the offense. And, that is a valve, a safety valve for some prisoners to be released. It doesn't apply to those who are serving life sentences or sentenced longer than 2 years. One idea that would make some sense, I think, is to consider a statute that would give old law inmates an opportunity to apply to their sentencing judge for release and taking that out from under the parole board. That is not currently a proposal, to my knowledge, but that is something that I think would make some sense in terms of giving an individual an opportunity to have what I think would be a more meaningful hearing than what is currently available with the parole board.
A lot of people have a lot of suspicions about why the system operates the way it does. Here's one from a caller now. Abba in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Abba.
Yeah, good morning, Liz. And good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, David.
Good morning.
Abba, just so you know, Cynthia Mauser isn't with us anymore. So, it's David Singleton. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. She and David, both David, talked about data as the determining factor for releasing the rehabilitated inmates.
Mm-hmm.
However, with the recent privatization of prisons, to what extent can we say that keeping them in prison is not actually for profit? And we know if we allow market forces to determine, you know, policies, it means prisoners will be left in the prison even though they are rehabilitated. And to what extent is the privatization actually fair to the prisoners?
Let's talk about that. Now, there aren't very many. Thanks, Abba, for that call. There aren't very many prisons that are privatized in Ohio. There are a few. Tend to be low security facilities, don't they?
That's correct. And, you know, that might be an issue in other jurisdictions, but we don't have in the state of Ohio very many private prisons. I think there are two or three, and they are lower security institutions. So the vast majority of those folks are not folks who are coming up, for consideration by the parole board. Excellent question, though, because in other parts of the country, private prisons play a much bigger role in incarcerating people, and those institutions, private prison institutions, have incentives to keep people in as long as possible. And, you know, there have been some very troubling reports about how private prison operators have, increased bogus, prison charges against people for violating administrative rules in order to keep them in longer and justify their continued incarceration. But that's not really a phenomenon in Ohio that is behind why we have so many frustrated people not getting out on parole.
Thanks, Abba, for that call. Karen in Columbus, you're on the air with David Singleton of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Referring to the intro story, I was just wondering, how does someone who's already been given a maximum sentence get more during the parole meeting?
Yeah,
isn't that double jeopardy?
Thanks, Karen, for the question. David Singleton, how do you explain that process? Cynthia Mauser says it's not that simple. That's not really what's happening.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think Chairwoman Mauser was right about one thing there, and that it's not that. Let's say that I'm given a sentence of 25 to life. Life is my max. Well, clearly there, there is no double jeopardy issue if I go at 25 years to the parole board and they give me, if they deny parole at that point and do what's called a flop, because the max is life. And they can continue to keep you there till you die. It may not be wise. It may not be a good use of resources for the state of Ohio because it costs over $25,000 a year to incarcerate someone, and it's just a tenth of it to put someone on parole. But that is not a double jeopardy violation, meaning you're punishing someone twice for the same offense. That's what double jeopardy is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get, let's say the sentence was, 18 years to 36 years. I'm just throwing that up hypothetically.
Mm-hmm.
You come up at 18 years for parole and you get continued for another 6 or 7 years, that is not imposing a different sentence than what the court gave you. It's just denying parole at that point. Now, my view is that the vast majority of folks who are getting denied are probably not going to reoffend when they get released. I think one of the things that's disappointing is I don't think the parole board adequately takes into consideration science in all of this. For example, young people who commit crimes when they're, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, particularly if they're male, their brains aren't fully developed. There's been a lot of science about that. The U.S. Supreme Court gets that now. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. Supreme Court recently struck down life without parole for juvenile offenders, is because of the brain science. That sort of stuff, the parole board needs to be taking into consideration, because someone who commits a violent crime when they are an adolescent, when they are, you know, are 19, 20, they're not going to be the same person 20 years from now. And that is not, in my view, adequately taken into consideration. And I think that's the kind of information that the parole board needs to be trained on if they're not being trained on that. And they need to actually be incorporating that if they're not. And it doesn't appear that they are.
Okay, Kieran, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. An email from Latoya. She says, I just wanted to add to David's point about the two-tier system. There are also inmates with indeterminate sentences with no maximum sentence. An example of this is 15 years to life. Essentially, someone with this sentence could go in front of the parole board every 3 years indefinitely without ever having an understanding of what they can do to improve their chances for release. It's a torturous process. Now, David Singleton, I did talk with Cynthia Mauser about that, and she says they do make recommendations. There's a comment section where they can share their insights with the inmates about why they didn't get it this time. Do you see that being used adequately?
Well, here's what happens. They do sometimes say, take this program. But then the person comes back and they've taken the program and completed it. And then they're continued again. It seems to be arbitrary. And frankly, I don't buy this notion that just because someone may not be adequately able to articulate what they got from a program, I don't think that means that they haven't been changed in some way.
They might just be a bad test taker.
They might be a bad tester. They might lack some of the communicative skills that are necessary to persuade the parole board. And in that judgment about whether or not you've learned something from a program is a very subjective determination, particularly if the parole board members are coming to this sort of very skeptical and more willing to write off than to believe in the person's ability to be redeemed. So, you know, I think it does matter that somebody's taken programming. I think almost by osmosis you learn something by opening yourself up to a program. So I don't buy what her explanation was for that.
An email from Karen, she says, I believe that most humans can be rehabilitated and that current brain science proves this. I'm all for keeping dangerous people locked up for public safety, but by the time someone sits in front of the parole board, I would expect that they have been through rigorous rehab and that 90% would be ready to reenter society. The 7% or lower parole rate is a horrendous incrimination of our prison system and how our tax money is being wasted. we're going to be talking about recidivism and, pardon me, rehabilitation in a coming program, but recidivism is often linked to rehabilitation programs. Is there a sense that there's enough programming out there, David Singleton, or could there be more, or what's your sense about that? We have just about a minute.
I think we need more programming. In the state of Michigan, they actually have heavily invested in what they call their prisoner reentry initiative to make sure that not only is there good programming in prison, but that in the community when people get released, they have good programming to be slotted into, and their recidivism rate is dropped dramatically as a result of that. So I think that there are things like that we should be looking at investing more in, because that's going to be more cost effective than continuing to flop people and continue them on parole. I mean, not on parole, but in prison, mm-hmm. while they could be released without compromising public safety and at a fraction of the cost to the taxpayers.
David Singleton, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
David Singleton, he's director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby. A production assistance from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannon, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.